Geekscape.com.
The truth about lynching and the Negroes in the South. Chapter 7, The Future of the Negro. Many solutions of the Negro problem have been proposed. Men so gifted with imagination that they do not find it necessary to consider either logic or facts over and again in a single speech or magazine article have solved it to their individual satisfaction. Such proposed solutions are usually no less preposterous than visionary. With these, I have nothing to do. As elsewhere in this study, so also here, I consider only what seems to have a firm basis of fact. However, in passing, I may be pardoned if I have the temerity to suggest the following, which, although seemingly fanciful, yet may have sufficient ground in reason as to merit some consideration. If about 100,000 square miles of territory on the Gulf of Mexico, embracing, say, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi River, excepting New Orleans, the southern part of Mississippi and Alabama, the part of Florida south of Alabama, and a small part of southwest Georgia, were set apart as a state or states, to which all the Negroes in other parts of the country be encouraged or obliged to migrate, it might result in a great good to both races. Something like half the population of this section are Negroes, while the whites that are here are mostly in the towns and cities. The area suggested is more than that of New York and Pennsylvania combined. There would be room for all Negroes in the country for generations to come, as the Negro states would be members of the Union, with representatives and senators in Congress. The Negroes would have an opportunity, under the federal government, to develop a political and social world of their own, removed from the overshadowing presence of the white man. If the Negro showed himself unable to develop the power of local self-government under such an arrangement, his case would be absolutely hopeless. However, there are so many difficulties in the way, and so many objections that might be made, that no one need either hope or fear that any such thing will ever be undertaken. But somewhat more in keeping with common sense and prevalent ideas is the proposal that Negroes be encouraged to distribute themselves equally over the country, thus relieving the South of its burden of Negro population. If such an equalization of the Negro population could be carried out, the Negro, then being everywhere few in numbers to the whites, could the better be held to the white man's standard of conduct. Not only so, but the Negro would have an opportunity to absorb the white man's civilization more quickly, if ever. In addition, the race question would cease to be sectional, and laws mutually advantageous to both races could then be passed. Before going further, even at the risk of digressing, for it is a matter of justice to the Negro, it should be said in favour of the Negro that even though he is the most alien race among us, no question as to his patriotism is ever raised. He has fought in all our great wars, and has shown himself patriotic to the core. A day or two after President Wilson had made his German war address before Congress, the writer happened by the Star Bulletin Board in Washington and noticed a German talking to a big, burly Negro against war with Germany. He pointed to the bulletin board and told him not to believe anything he saw there, for it was all lies made in London. The Negro seemed to listen in a half-disgusted sort of way, but as he started off, he was understood to say, "I wish I was with some coloured soldiers in Europe. We would show the Germans how to fight." The Negro has no kindred country to look to, so he is undivided in his allegiance. This cannot be said of all other races among us, not of the Japanese and Chinese who seek admission to our Pacific shores. Like the Negro, they cannot be assimilated by our people. In numbers, however, they would constitute a much more dangerous element to our welfare and safety than the Negro. Japan is almost abreast of our civilization, and the Western nations are doing their best to train China to be an antagonist worthy of their steel, should you ever have cause to cross swords with them. Large numbers of Chinese and Japanese would not only add to our race problems, but would increase our chances for friction with their home governments. In addition, they might constitute a reverse army of the enemy in our midst in case of war. But no such danger need be feared from the presence of the Negro. I have just adverted to the fact that the yellow race and the black are not easily assimilated with the white race. It may be well that it is so. To the normal white man, amalgamation with these races is almost unthinkable. Nevertheless, there are a few misguided individuals who surely have either a mental or a moral twist, who persist in joining together that which nature has put asunder. A few years ago, a minister sent the following telegram to the governor of California. "I have just married a Japanese to an American and have done more for God and Uncle Sam than the alien land bill will do in 1,000 years. It is not the ungodly that cause the suffering in the world, so much as the bigoted, if well-intentioned, fools. Self-elected good people can usually be counted on to cause a lot of mischief. If those who set themselves up as leaders and ethical teachers would but first make sure that they were possessed of at least a fair amount of common sense." In a recent Methodist conference at Roanoke, Virginia, the statement was made that the records of some churches in Massachusetts show that in the previous year, 17% of the marriages were those in which Negro men married white women, or white men married Negro women. This is the more remarkable when account is taken of the very small Negro population of that state. It is even sometimes asserted that the Negro would bring to the white race some qualities which would tend towards the development of a more perfect man. But such an idea has no basis in fact. The following quotation is to the point. "We have ample experience to go upon in South America, in the West Indies, and in the southern states themselves. The mulatto exists and has existed for generations, not in hundreds or thousands, but in millions. In what respect has he proved himself the superior of the pure Spaniard or Portuguese or Anglo-Saxon? Does South American history bear testament to his political competence? Have his achievements in science, in literature, in music been superior to the un-Africanized peoples? Or, waiving the question of superiority, has he ever, in these domains, produced meritorious work in any fair proportion to his numbers? I do not say that it is impossible to make out a sort of case for him, by the ransacking of records and the employment of a very indefinite standard of values. But I do most emphatically say that no conspicuous or undeniable advantage has resulted from the blending of bloods, such as can or ought to counteract the instinctive repugnance of the South." It is said that an investigation of 2,200 Negro authors showed that nearly all of them come from the mixed stock. How many of these would take first, second, or even third rank in the literary world? It is needless to answer. Indeed, Negroes and mulattoes have been toilers in the United States for generations, but who ever heard of an important labor-saving instrument invented by them? The same abilities or characteristics which would make a white man only locally important would make a Negro or a mulatto famous. There were thousands upon thousands of white men, intellectually and otherwise superior to Booker T. Washington, who gained but little recognition. But because he was a Negro, or rather mulatto, Washington's abilities stood out in striking relief. Mulattoes ought to furnish the leaders of the Negro race, for the best white blood runs in the veins of some of them. Although mulattoes may furnish the Negro leaders, there can be no doubt that they also furnish far beyond their share of the vicious and the criminal elements of the race as well. It may be pertinent in this connection, however, to observe that in the South, the two races have been gradually drawing apart. Amalgamation or miscegenation is becoming more and more repugnant. The conditions which favoured it do not obtain to anything like the extent as formerly. As a consequence, the mixing between the whites and the blacks is rapidly lessening. Although the census shows an increase in the number of mulattoes from decade to decade, the increase is mainly due to the mixing of mulattoes with pure Negroes. Some students of the subject, who seemingly are more familiar with the conditions in the North and the border states than with those of the farther South, sometimes estimate from one-third to one-half of the Negroes in the United States to be mulattoes. This, I am confident, is a mistake. I was reared in a border state, have spent some time in the North as well as in several southern states, and have been in many of the leading cities of the South. My observation leads me to believe that the census, in this respect, is more nearly correct than any other source of information. The agents of the census in 1910 were instructed to report as black all persons who were evidently full-blood Negroes, and as mulattoes all other persons having some proportion or perceptible trace of Negro blood. Accordingly, in a population of 9,928,000 Negroes in the United States, there were found to be 2,050,000 mulattoes, 20.9%, or a little more than one-fifth. By geographic divisions, the percentage of mulattoes among the Negroes was as follows. New England, 33.4%. Middle Atlantic States, 19.6%. East North Central, 33.2%. West North Central, 28.7%. South Atlantic, 20.8%. East South Central, 19.1%. West South Central, 20.1%. Mountain, 28.6%. And Pacific States, 24.7%. Of the northern states, Michigan took first place with 47% of mulattoes among her Negroes. Maine was next with 45.9%, and Wisconsin third with 39.4%. Those with the smallest percentage were Wyoming, 13.1%, New Jersey, 15.8%, and Pennsylvania, 19.2%. The southern states having the largest percentage were Virginia, 33.2%, West Virginia, 32.5%, and Missouri, 28.4%. A large number of states in the South had a small percentage of mulattoes among their Negroes. Maryland, 18.6%, Georgia, 17.3%, Mississippi, 16.9%, Alabama, 16.7%, South Carolina, 16.1%, Florida, 16.0%, Delaware, 11.9%, and the eastern shore of Maryland, which borders Delaware on two sides, had only 11.1%, or one mulatto to every nine Negroes. Thus, the eastern shore has the distinction of having fewer mulattoes in proportion to its Negro population than any other section. It is therefore evident that in the North, the proportion of mulattoes among the Negroes is from about one-fifth to almost one-half, while in the South, the proportion ranges from above one-eighth to about one-third. In the states where the bulk of the Negro population is found, it is only about one-sixth. With slight exception, it seems to be true that the fewer to the white population, the more mulattoes there are in proportion to the number of the Negroes. Indeed, may it not be true that the much larger proportional number of mulattoes among the Negroes of the North in no small measure accounts for the greater proportional amount of crime among the Negroes of the North. So it would appear that the amalgamation or miscegenation of the whites and the Negroes is not a levelling up, but rather a levelling down process. At best, nothing otherwise than building up the Negro by lowering the white. So no greater nor more fearful calamity could befall the white race in America than that the Negro should lose his identity through being absorbed by this great division of the Anglo-Saxon race. Again, many optimistic white men have thought that the Negro could be raised to the white man's level by means of the training and culture that comes through the study of books. To these, education for the Negro has been a watchword. To a large extent, Southern whites have been in sympathy with the education of the Negro. Indeed, many years ago, contrary to what one not familiar with the South might suppose, a prominent man in North Carolina, in seeking a congressional nomination on a platform hostile to Negro education, failed even to carry his home county, and efforts to restrict the amount appropriated to Negro schools to the part of the school taxes paid by Negroes have failed. Since 1870, the South has spent on Negro education around $230 million and is now appropriating for that purpose near $10 million annually. It is doubtful if the Negro contributes in taxes even half the amount spent on his public schools. In 1912, according to the educational report of that state, North Carolina spent $436,000 to $480,000 for Negro teachers and Negro school buildings, of which the Negro contributed in taxes for schools $190,000, or a little more than two-fifths. Texas spends not far from $2 million a year on Negro schools, and Georgia about $850,000. The District of Columbia, indeed, spends more per capita on Negro pupils than on whites. However, this is a notable exception. There are also more than 600 private and denominational schools of secondary and college grade in the United States for the higher education of the Negro. The property of these is valued at around $28,500,000. From 1865 to 1917, about $65 million has been contributed to Negro education in the South through various religious and philanthropic organizations. But notwithstanding the fact that the illiteracy of the Negro race had been reduced by 1910 to about 33%, there is a widespread feeling of disappointment in Negro education. Not that it has made the Negro more criminal, as has sometimes been said. However, this is not yet well determined, but rather that it has failed to make him a greater producer, or to aid him to adjust himself to economic conditions, instead of firing him with a desire to do more and better work. Too often he quits it altogether. As a teacher or a preacher, the Negro has a wide field, for his race needs him, and the state and the church pay him. But as a doctor, lawyer, or other professional, poverty and pauperism, the condition of the greater part of the Negro race, militate against them. In addition, the Negro has not yet sufficient confidence in the professional skill of those of his own race as to cause him to employ them exclusively. There is a growing conviction in the South that the first aim of Negro education should be to fit the Negro for the opportunities of his social and industrial environment. Also, that it should endeavour to strengthen his willpower in order that he may overcome his constitutional inertia, and that it should give him a knowledge of sanitary living, thus preventing disease. In the South Carolina Public School Report for 1915, the State Superintendent of Schools has this to say. The Negro is here, and he is here to stay. He cannot remain ignorant without injury to himself, his white neighbours, and to the Commonwealth. His training should fit him for the work that is open to him. While industrial education is needed for both races, it is especially desirable for the Negro. The money now expended for Negro education is largely wasted. Can we afford any longer to allow this large element in our population to follow their present practices and remain in their present condition? Such schools as Hampton Institute and Tuskegee have fairly well demonstrated that industrial education is at least a good thing for the Negro. In these and other such schools, thousands have been given an inspiration for a higher plane of living. Indeed, it is claimed that very seldom is any graduate of these two schools convicted of crime. The influence of Tuskegee on the Negro in a material way may be appreciated by the statement that in 1881, when the school was opened in Macon County, Alabama, not more than 50 or 60 Negroes in the county owned land. But in 1910, 503 Negroes in the county owned 61,689 acres. Probably the largest amount of land owned by the Negroes of any county in the United States. If a few Negro industrial schools make such a good showing, then why not multiply the number? Indeed, it is yet too early for either the Negro or his friends to indulge in too much optimism in regards to the matter. For while it may be true in general that whatever is done in behalf of a lower element in a society benefits the whole society, at the same time, it needs to be borne in mind that to the extent that it is done to the cost or by the neglect of a more homogeneous and wholesome element in the society, or if it in any way militates against such element, it is a questionable proceeding. What if the industrial education of the Negro should be found to conflict with the interests of the white labourer or skilled worker? Does anyone suppose that it is the purpose of the South so to educate the Negro, or even allow him to be so educated as to enable him to take the bread from the white man's mouth? And does anyone suppose that the labouring white man of the arrogant and aggressive Anglo-Saxon race will stand tamely by with folded arms while there is danger of its being done? This is the central point of the whole situation. But in the South, the contest between these two conflicting interests is not yet, as the demand for labour skilled or unskilled is too great. The Negro has had, and can have, all the work he wants and more for the asking. Indeed, often his labour is anxiously solicited. How long this will continue, no one knows positively. However, when the population of the country reaches 150 million or 200 million, then labour will likely be as plentiful here as it is now in Europe. Then, the labour of the Negro will hardly be solicited. Rather otherwise, the white man's sympathetic attitude towards the Negro's many shortcomings is fast passing. When the Negro is required to measure up to the white man's standard and is found wanting, what remains for him? Furthermore, the Negro might as well get fully in mind that although the white man sometimes may win without merit, yet often fails to win, even though deserving to do so, for the Negro himself, even though merit may not win, without it, he will have absolutely no show. He must be not only as well adapted to an occupation or qualified for it as a white man, but better. Until lately, those especially interested in the welfare of the Negro might have entertained the hope that he would hold his place in his customary occupations, or even make them in great part his very own. This would have been a kind of segregation to occupation, analogous to his segregation as regards residence, and at least as advantageous to him. But in hardly more than one occupation is such the case. As a porter, he seems to have the field practically to himself, and as hod carrier, he is in demand. But as a barber, he has been fast losing ground. The Negro, as a waiter, takes more pride in his occupation and is more polite and obliging than the white man of the waiter class, but he is even being displaced in this work, even as a farm labourer, for which service he has been trained for generations. He is losing his grip. Too slow, unreliable, inefficient are some of the counts against him. The idea that prevails outside the South, that Negroes do practically all the work on southern farms, is far from the truth. More than half of the cotton crop is raised by white labour. In Texas, three quarters or more. Even in sugar and rice fields, white labour is getting common. Often indeed, a farmer will not employ a Negro if he can get a white man. Indeed, the Negro farm labourer and the Negro farmer are the greatest stumbling blocks in the way of the agricultural development of the South. Were it possible to remove from the South at least three quarters of these and replace them with whites, whether native or foreign, there can be no doubt that the production of southern farms would be wonderfully increased. It is an injury to the South and to society as a whole that the Negro has under his control even as much land as at present. When his slipshod farming gives place to more scientific and business-like methods, there will be more farm products for distribution. The inefficiency of the Negro as a farmer is strikingly shown by a study of the conditions in several Mississippi counties. Loudness County, with three Negroes to one white man, having 21,972 blacks and 7,121 whites, requires 3.15 acres to make a bale of cotton, while James County, with three whites to one Negro, having 13,156 whites and 4,670 blacks, requires 1.98 acres to make a bale. The farmlands of Jones County are valued in the census reports at $2.85 per acre, and the farmlands of Loudness County at $9.83 an acre. Yet the poor lands of Jones County, under intelligent cultivation, produced nearly twice as much per acre as the rich lands of Loudness County when cultivated mostly by Negroes. In every comparison made between a white county and a black one, the black was the most fertile, yet the white was nearly twice as productive. Such a poor showing for the Negro almost persuades one that he deserves to be supplanted by whites in farm work and in farming, even if he should not be. At present, the South holds out unequalled attractions in the way of climate, rich soil, and cheap lands to those of other sections of the country who may be seeking farm homes. And there can be little doubt that with the passing of the free public lands, the tide of immigration in the near future will set in that direction, in spite of the presence of the Negro. Then what will become of the Negro, when he shall have to compete with the thrifty, hard-working Poles, Bohemians, and Native Americans from the North and the West? Will he be simply pushed aside and left to gravitate to a still lower level? Nothing will save him unless he soon wonderfully changes in habits and disposition. So the Negro may as well look forward to the time when he will be supplanted in these occupations to which he thinks himself so well adapted, and in which he thinks himself so well fortified, those of farm labourer and farmer. Finally, may not the unquestioned physical deterioration of the Negro since his emancipation, as shown by his susceptibility to disease, together with his high death rate, portend the ultimate practical extinction of the race in the United States? During slavery times, the Negro was fairly well fed and usually worked according to set regulations. Evidently, such food and training had no little to do with developing a sound body and disciplined his mind to some extent as well. According to Debeau, the mortality of the free Negroes before the war was 100% greater than that of the slaves, It even appears that the death of the Negroes in the South at that time was less than that of the whites. In Charleston, SC, the average death rate from 1822 to 1861 was 25.98 a thousand for whites and 24.05 for Negroes. About the same was true of some other cities. From 1865 to 1894, however, the average death rate at Charleston was 26.77 a thousand for whites and 43.29 for Negroes. No doubt, the slight increase of the death rate among the whites was due to the rapid increase among the Negroes, as the whites necessarily came more or less in contact with the Negroes. Indeed, very significant in this connection is the statement made in the Negro Yearbook, 1914-15, that an average of 450,000 Negroes in the South are seriously ill all the time, and that 600,000 of the present population will die of tuberculosis. The census shows that both pneumonia and tuberculosis are diseases very fatal to Negroes, and strange as it may now seem, in slavery times, Negroes were thought to be practically immune from tuberculosis. Indeed, it is said that about 1882-83, there was exhibited at a clinic in Charleston, South Carolina, what was supposed to have been the second case of tuberculosis ever found among Negroes. This is very remarkable, if true. In each city of the following list of 12 is given the number of times more deaths that occurred from tuberculosis among Negroes in 1910, according to the census, than among whites. Providence, 1.82. Richmond, 2.05. Boston, 2.46. Atlanta, 2.48. New York, 2.64. New Orleans, 2.70. Memphis, 2.80. Philadelphia, 3.0. Baltimore, 3.14. Washington, 3.34. Charleston, 3.55. It may be noticed that more than 3.5 times as many Negroes as whites died of tuberculosis in Charleston. The comparative statistics for pneumonia differ not very much from those of tuberculosis. However, the ratio of death rate from combined causes is much lower than this. The average death rate, 1,000, in 8 northern states in 1910 was 21.9 for Negroes and 15.1 for whites, while the average for 2 southern states was 23.7 for Negroes and 15.2 for whites. In 10 northern cities, it was 23.64 for Negroes and 15.99 for whites. For the same number of cities in the South, it was 13.60 for Negroes and 17.22 for whites. Again, in 33 northern cities, the death rate among Negroes was 25.1 a thousand and 15.7 among whites, while in 24 southern cities the death rate was 29.6 for Negroes and 16.9 for whites. For the 57 cities together, 27.8 for Negroes and 15.9 for whites. Thus, it is seen that the death rate among Negroes is not far from twice as great as among whites, but contrary to the general impression, it is less in the North than in the South. Moreover, statistics show that the Negro is not increasing in this country as fast in proportion as is the white man. Indeed, he seems to be falling behind in his own percentage of increase. Between 1890 and 1900, his increase was 1,345,318. But from 1900 to 1910, it was only 993,769. Again, the percentage of Negroes in the population of the country decreased from 19.03% in 1810 to 10.69% in 1910, and from 14.13% in 1860 to 10.69% in 1910. In other words, while the whites increased nearly 3.5 times between 1860 and 1910, the Negro only increased 2.2 times. Now, this difference between the increase of the two races was not due to the immigration of whites. It's shown by the fact that from 1800 to 1840, when there was scarcely any immigration of whites, the population of the country increased more than 3.25 times, while from 1870 to 1910, an equal number of years, when immigration was almost at its height, the increase was only a little more than 2.3 times. Again, during the 50 years, 1790 to 1840, it increased 4.3 times. Also between 1810 and 1860, it increased in the same ratio, 4-34, while for the 50 years from 1860 to 1910, it increased only something more than 2.75 times. Indeed, it is said that the southern states, which have received practically no immigrants since the Civil War, have increased their population as rapidly as the northern states. That is, the increase of population among the southern whites has been equal to the northern increase, assisted by immigration. While these facts may not be sufficient evidence that the Negro will finally become extinct in this country, nevertheless, it is impossible for one to escape the conclusion that as the years go by, the members of his race will become fewer and fewer in proportion to the whole population. As this comes about, the Negro will gradually cease to be such a problem as at present. If only, is all I have to say to that. If only that were true.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.